back to Topical Currents. I'm Peter Jay, sitting in for Bonnie Berman on this segment. And joining us now, as always, on a Thursday afternoon, is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Peter. So nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have this chance, too.
Well, Peter, honey, it's a wonder food. Now, did you know? Here's a
Don't
a
call
fact.
Me honey, by the way. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Oh, I always with you, Peter.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. I can see that coming.
Yeah.
Thank you. What I do for work here. Mm-hmm. Well, did you know that 1 in 3 bites of food we eat is derived from plants that have been pollinated by bees? Mm. That's amazing. And this amazed me, and it brought home the importance of the fact that honeybees are dying out in alarming numbers. And our guests are here to help us and give us information about this very disturbing situation. John Gensel, he's a beekeeper in Homestead, and he's on the board of the Dade County Farm Bureau. So welcome, John Gensel.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're so happy to have you here with us.
Thank you.
And Aaron Mullins, he's a senior biological scientist at the University of Florida Fort Lauderdale Research and Education Center. So welcome, Aaron Mullins.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And of course, as you just heard his voice, our favorite wine guy is with us, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column. And you can also read Fred's wine column in Saturday's Herald now. No longer Thursday, it's on Saturday. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I'm going to talk about bees and wine and whether they're important to each other.
All right, sounds interesting. A few more amazing facts. Did you know that the average worker honeybee makes just 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in its lifetime? And it takes 1,152 honeybees to fill a 1-pound jar of honey. So, Aaron Mullins, what is the state of the bee population in the U.S.?
Well, we're definitely seeing a decline, especially starting in about 2006, 2007. With the 2005, actually, I think it was when it was first reported, but colony collapse disorder. But even before that, we were seeing a steady decline in the bee population due to a lot of new issues that honeybees are facing.
Well, let me ask you, without bees, how do we pollinate our crops?
Well, you don't, really. I don't know of too many alternatives. I don't know if you can, potentially hand pollination. There's other things. There's also native bees that do a pretty good job. But honeybees are definitely the most important pollinator that we have.
Well, John Gensel, what's happening here in South Florida to our bee population?
It's about the same. We're losing them all over the place. It's hard to keep the bees alive today. And you was talking about pollination. When you go out to the field, you got thousands of bees that's working the flowers, and you can't hand pollinate 1,000 acres of squash or cucumbers and things like that. In a house home, you can go out there and hand pollinate them, but not when you're growing thousands
major
of acres.
Major crops. And I understand the almond crop in California is totally populated by bees, and that they make all the almonds practically, well, all from the United States for sure, and from most of the world.
Yes, there's, I believe there's 380-something truckloads of bees that left Florida going to California almonds this year, they said, at the last meeting I was at, because there's so short of bees in California and all over the United States that they go there for the almonds, they go to Maine, they go all over the United States.
Either Aaron or John, whoever, why are the bees dying? What's happening to them?
Well, there are so many different things that they're classifying as pesticides and viruses, mutated viruses. You got the beetles, you got two different mites, and various other things. You want to chime in there, Mr. Aaron?
Yeah, you know, beekeeping 30 years ago was a completely different game. You really only had 6 diseases or issues that you needed to watch out for. You know, bees get sick just like everything else. But you only really had 6. Starting in the late 80s, we started to see these new things pop up. And a lot of them are parasites, things that were jumping over from related species of bees in Asia that had finally worked their way across in Europe and then somehow managed to make it over here. But in the late 80s, we had a varroa mite, a tracheal mite, rather, that came in. then mid-90s, you had this tracheal mite, this varroa mite come in, small hive beetles.
So when you say these mites, I have a picture here that John Kensel brought to me of a bee and the mite attacking the bees. So this is what happened. These mites attack the bees and kill them? Is that what happens?
Yeah, these mites are parasites. So what they do are they're like fleas on your dog, except they're huge. You know, if you think about, if you were a worker bee, this mite would be about the size of a frisbee walking around on you.
Wow.
And they actually suck the blood from the bees, and they suck the blood from the developing bee larva. And now the issue is not so much that they're sucking the blood from these insects, but they're actually transferring or vectoring a lot of diseases, other viruses that don't usually cause problems with bees. But now that we have this vector, just like mosquitoes and malaria, you're having all these new viruses come into play.
You know, what I'm wondering is, this sounds like a really crucial problem, and yet I don't hear much about it at the national level. You never see it on Fox or CNN or anything like that. Are people not paying attention, or what's going on?
Researchers are paying attention, and we've been paying attention to this for quite a while, especially these new diseases that are showing up as a result of the mites. Now, the media, for some reason, always wants to talk about colony collapse disorder, just because it's the big shrouded mystery. We still don't really have a good understanding of what is causing it, other than we think it's a complex, it's the result of a synergy, a lot of different things that are greater than the sum of its parts. And it's
was anybody in charge of doing something about it? I mean, it sounded like you need a national effort.
Oh, there is. There's the national MAAREC, and I'm not going to have an easy time remembering what all that stands for.
I mean, how crucial is this? Is this something that should have a cabinet-level person after it, or are we going to run out of food? I don't quite understand the scope of it.
Well, I believe it does. Actually, Obama just last month, I think, assigned a new, delegated some more research funds to research honeybee health, and that's really what we're working on. But there are a lot of people working on this, but it's still just a mystery.
So there's nothing really at the moment that can be done about this?
Management practices. We're doing our best to educate beekeepers on how to treat these things as they show up.
Well, John Gensel, what are you doing? Are you losing your hives, or what's happening with your farms?
Yes, we're losing them just like everybody else. When we go out to work them, sometimes we'll have one or two dead. Or we might have 10 dead.
You're talking about dead hives.
Dead hives that we pick up, yes. It's either, you have the different mites and plus the CCD, plus the viruses.
The CCD? What was
colony collapse disorder.
Okay.
But you can't pinpoint it. You have to have somebody up the road to come down and look at the stuff to see if it, your dead stuff is CCD related, or whether it's mite, nobody knows. It's, you bring it in, you start over, clean it up, and put bees back in it. That's all we can do.
How difficult is it to attain new bees?
It's hard. You take what you got, and you can split them, or you can buy them from different people that raises bees and queens. Mm-hmm. But it's like everything else. It's supply and demand, and the queens and the sales are getting higher and higher and more expensive, and it's hard to start over and
well,
stuff
you mentioned
to get going.
To me, I asked you earlier before we were on air, what happens when the queen bee dies? What happens with the bees in the hive?
Well, it depends on what it is that's killing them. If your queen bee just dies and the hive is strong enough, you can either buy new queens and put in them if you catch them in time, or let them raise their own queen by changing the sex of the larva to a queen.
So the bees can reproduce a queen within the hive?
Yes. If they're strong enough and good enough, they can replace them themselves, but it's something that we don't want to do in Florida.
Are there any specific pesticides that seem to be at fault?
Well, they say the neonicotines and the septimic poisons that's coming out, going into the flower. And when that flower comes up, it secretes the poison sometimes, and they're going back. That's something else that they're working with now to find out on the larva state of the bee, because it seemed like it's not affecting the the adult bee, they say, nobody really knows what it is. It's that, it's trucking, it's these viruses, it's everything that's mutated into one.
Is anybody addressing that problem?
Yes, there's three different, Pennsylvania is working on it with North Carolina, I believe it is, and also Florida, all in one. We're trying to get a new bee lab built now, trying to get funds for it, where they can work more digitally and more effectively to try to find out what the problem is.
Right. Well, let's talk about bees in general, because I think a lot of people just don't even know. What most of us know about a bee is we don't want to be near one, okay?
Right.
So there's a honeybee, which is different from the bees that swarm. Is that correct?
Well, honeybees swarm.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, honeybees definitely swarm. That's something unique to honeybees is that the queen is never alone. So whereas most of our native bees, bumblebees, sweat bees, all those other carpenter bees, the queen actually sets out and starts out alone. Like she sets up shop, and if they are social, like bumblebees, she'll get started and she'll eventually have a stable full of workers that actually do the work for her. They go to the flowers, they collect, they do the pollinating, they do all that. Honeybees are unique in that they swarm, and that means that when the queen leaves the hive to reproduce or to split the hive or to start a new beehive, half the workers go with her. She's never alone.
So that's how we find sometimes unique bees in our homes.
So when you see that blob of bees in the tree, you know, yeah, that everybody always freaks out, that's actually a swarm. And that what has happened is the queen bee has left a hive and she landed on the tree and half the workers went and landed with her. And they're staging, that's their staging area. They're trying to figure out a new place to go when you see that.
Okay. Well, we're going to need to take a little break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking about the dangerous depletion of the honeybee population. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we've been talking about the honeybees, how that they're dying off in alarming numbers, and what it means to our food supply, and perhaps even to our existence. Our guests are John Gensels. He's a bees keeper in Homestead, and he's on the board of the Dade County Farm Bureau. And Aaron Mullins is a senior biological scientist at the University of Florida Fort Lauderdale Research and Education Center. They've been giving us some really, really amazing information about what's happening and what needs to be done, and kind of frightening, I think. Don't you think, Peter?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But right now, it's dinner and minutes time.
Okay.
So I picked a honey one, a honey dinner. Mm-hmm. It's almond chicken with orange honey sauce and garlic zucchini strips with grape tomatoes. Now, it's made with boneless, skinless chicken breasts. Now, you keep them really juicy and flavorful by this orange sauce that's thickened with honey. And John Gensel's got a big smile on his face because he sells honey. The side dish is made, I make zucchini strips, so I just cut the strips lengthwise on the zucchini. I just use a potato peeler to do it, and the grape tomatoes, and they're both cooked in a little olive oil and garlic. Very simple. And that can be done in the microwave, so just put it all in the microwave. And for the chicken, I coat thin chicken cutlets with some cornstarch, and then I mix it with a little red pepper, and saute them just 2 minutes aside. The cutlets are very thin. They're only a half inch thick. Remove them, and I add some orange juice and honey to the skillet, and the honey thickens. The orange juice gives a little sweetness to it. Just spoon the sauce over the chicken. That's a 15-minute meal. Mm-hmm. And Peter's looking at me with his mouth open.
Yeah, that's sounding pretty good. Does it matter what kind of honey you use? I know there's clover honey and orange honey.
No, it's up to you.
Yeah,
whatever kind. And John Gensel's
yeah,
shaking
all, there's
his
all
head.
Different types of honey.
Uh-huh. Any recommendations, John, for cooking with honey? What's the best honey to cook with?
Well, it all depends on each of your taste. There's orange blossom, there's tupelo, there's clover, there's all different types of table-grade honey plus bakery honey that sells to the bakeries.
Oh, and there's Gensel honey.
Oh.
Yeah, and there's Gensel's honey, right.
Okay, so any kind. With a complete recipe and a photo, that's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter, at L. Gassenheimer. So Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, Linda, when you told me about today's show, you asked me a question, which was, Do grapevines need bees for pollination in order to make wine? And my intelligent answer was, say what? I had no idea. But this, like anything else, can be Googled. So I hope you experts will correct me if I'm wrong. This is what I found by Googling. It's pretty, really pretty interesting. A few Native American grape varieties like Scuppernong and Catawba need bees. Not regular honeybees. They're too big to get into the blossoms. They need tiny little sweat bees, which might explain the flavors of some of those wines. Regular grapes like Chardonnay and Merlot don't need bees. And none of this gets a little embarrassing. Most regular grapes are hermaphroditic, with both male stamens and female ovaries, so they can, you should pardon the expression, self-pollinate. And all they need is gravity and the wind. And this
remember,
is good
this
news
is
in a way because of the
this is a family
Fred,
show.
Yeah,
right?
This is a family show, Fred, you know, NPR.
We're telling you it's a family show. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm through with that part.
Okay.
And if we're all starving, at least we can go out with a good buzz. And now there is a good strong link between bees and wine, and that's mead, sometimes called honey wine because it's made from honey. Mm. Historians think the world's first alcoholic beverage was discovered by Fred Flintstone and Barney when they tipped over a beehive and got rainwater in it. And there just happened to be some wild yeast drifting by, and the two prehistoric pals discovered the world's first hangovers. And of course, until regular wine and beer came along centuries later, people were happy to have mead. The ancient Greeks called it ambrosia, the nectar of the gods, and they thought it descended from the heavens like the dew and was collected by the bees. Unfortunately, today, mead is not very popular with most folks. I've had it a couple of times, and I think it's kind of heavy and sweet. But I understand a few wineries are making better meads these days, and you can ask for it at your local wine shop. And if they don't have it, you can Google the website of Hidden Legend Winery in Victor, Montana. From there, you can order up a bottle of pure honey mead for $17.99. So don't say you never learned anything on this show.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's ask our experts. What do you know anything about the grapevines and bees and what's needed? No? John?
Sounds good to me. I've never actually worked with grapevines, so I honestly, I don't know the answer to that question.
And John's saying the same thing. He doesn't.
I just have a question. What would you gentlemen say are the foods most critically affected by problems with bees? I mean, are we talking wheat for bread? Are we talking most vegetables? What are the most critical food items that are affected by this problem?
Vegetables are going to be the most important thing. I've got a list here in front of me, but basically anything that comes from a flower, virtually anything,
except
for grapes, apparently. But, you know, here in Florida, we've got oranges, very important.
Mm-hmm. It's an important crop in general, just financially for us.
Sure.
Yeah. Financially, but most fruit, peas, beans, tomatoes. Mm. Peppers, squash, melons, cucumbers, they're all insect-pollinated. Greens typically are not, you know, corn, your wheat, those things, they don't need it.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this a world problem or just in the United States?
It is. It's a worldwide problem. It's certainly much, much more prevalent here in the United States and in Europe, which are the primary places where people are keeping honeybees.
Exactly.
So Southeast Asia and that area, they aren't having the problem?
Southeast Asia is loaded with other kinds of bees, actually. So they're not dealing with honeybee. In fact, a lot of these new diseases have sprung up from other species of bees that are really prevalent in Asia. And so they're not necessarily managed, although sometimes they are, but they're just wild populations. And I don't know if much research has been done on the status of those populations, but I've certainly not heard anything about a huge decline.
So let me understand something. I think I'm hearing this, that it doesn't have to be a honeybee that pollinates the vegetables, the fruits, the growing the produce.
So
why can't we just bring in some other types of bees?
That was my question. Uh-huh.
Well, Here's the story. Actually, bumblebees are much better pollinators than honeybees are. If you think about it, they're huge, they're fuzzy, they're clumsy, they bump into things, they really get that pollen everywhere. It's a big, you know, they make a big mess everywhere they go. The beauty of honeybees and the reason why the honeybees are our most important pollinator is because they're so manageable. There's no other bee that you can put in a box, put on a car or a train, or, you know, the ancient Egyptians used to take honeybees on rafts and go up and down the Nile and use them as pollinators. They're so mobile, they're so manageable. They're domesticated. They're, you know, a domesticated animal that we have.
So we wouldn't be able to control the other bees.
Well, yeah, and it would just be really difficult to manage their population. You know, honeybees, you know, bumblebees, they have the solitary period. Another beauty of honeybees is that they overwinter as a, you know, it's not as much of an issue here in Florida, but in the north, they overwinter as a hive, whereas most solitary bees, bumblebees, overwinter as a solitary queen. So when the first warm day of winter comes, you just have this one solitary queen going out and doing all the work. Whereas with honeybees, you've got a hive full of 20,000 bees that are all ready to go. So the first flowers open.
I suppose a bumblebee sting is worse than a honeybee sting too, right?
A little bit, yeah. Not that bad, though. They can sting multiple times. Honeybees, of course, can only sting once. But,
oh, is that right?
Yeah,
so
but don't worry
bumblebees.
About that. Yeah. John, yeah, but they don't want to.
I want to ask John here if you've had experience working with other bees other than honeybees.
I've seen them put the bumblebees in the fields because they say the bees are not doing what they're supposed to, but I've never seen the bumblebees out working, basically. And I think there, Aaron can check me out here, but I think a lot of shortage on bumblebees down here, especially in Florida, than what they are in North Carolina and different places like that. But I know the farmers are trying to use them because they say they're so much better. But I've gone up and kicked the boxes and nothing come out of them, so I don't know when they work, day or night.
They're lazy.
That's the thing, is they're just tricky. You know, it's tricky to manage them. And you can buy them, sure, but they don't survive very well. They're not domestic animals, you know. They're not...
Yeah, that's hard to keep them alive.
But I just wanted to mention, you mentioned honey in the honeybees in Egypt. And I came across another interesting fact, that they found honey in the pyramids that were thousands of years old, and it's still good.
Yeah.
It's what they call granulated, and it's, you know, older, but it's still good and edible because honey don't go bad.
Well, they had to make that mead.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
That's what they were interested in. But, you know, this has been really fascinating. We could go on with it,
amen.
But we're almost out of time. John Gensel from Gensel's Bees, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's been really, we appreciate
been a pleasure.
Learning about it. And Aaron Mullins, a senior biological scientist at the University of Florida, Fort Lauderdale Research and Education Center. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, next week we'll be talking about back to school. Can't believe it's here already. Back to school lunches. We'll be talking with Penny Parham from Miami-Dade and Mary Mulder from Broward County. They'll give us all the new scoop this year. I'm Linda Gassenheimer.